our new podcast series, Access Injustice, which is hosted by Communicourt. During this series, we are going to be talking to a number of guests about how fair access to justice really is for people with communication difficulties. Joining us for our next episode, we are really excited and thankful to welcome Christian Boache and Jackie Leroyd. Christian is a speech and language therapist currently working at Feltham Young Offenders Institution, and Jackie is the lead speech and language therapist at HMP Berwyn. Both Jackie and Christian are passionate about the speech, language and communication needs of people in prison. I should just mention from the outset that the views expressed in this podcast are Christian and Jackie's, and not necessarily those of the Central and North West London NHS Foundation Trust or BCUHB in NHS Wales. Christian and Jackie, welcome to Accessing Justice podcast, and thank you for finding the time to talk to us. Between you both, you have a great deal of experience working with both young men and adults within the prison population. It's recognised that there is a high prevalence of speech, language, communication and swallowing needs amongst people in the criminal justice system. Firstly, what are your experiences of the level of communication needs in prisons and the young offending settings?
So first of all, thank you very much for having us. It's a pleasure to be here, pleasure to be invited. And I'd say in my role as a speech and language therapist in HMP YY Feltham, my experience of communication needs is actually reflective of the research amongst young offenders. So dating back to 2007, there was evidence that up to 90% of those assessed had poor language skills. More recent research puts the figure around 72%. But essentially, there's a high prevalence of speech language communication needs. And the reason for that varies, I'd say. So you might have those young people with underlying language difficulties, but also there's also a high prevalence of neurodevelopmental conditions that can co-occur with language difficulties or can be standalone. So for example, in the general population, there's about, I think, ADHD, prevalence ADHD is about 4%. But when you come to custodial settings, that increases to about 25%. And obviously that has an impact on a person's ability to concentrate and communicate. It's the same with autism, where prevalence in general population is about 1%. But again, in custodial settings, it's about 5 to 19%. There's also the added difficulty of literacy difficulties that can affect how someone sort of like read or understand information given to them, as well as the added stresses of prisons, which I'm sure my colleague Jackie will touch on. In terms of swallowing difficulties for a young offender population, thankfully we don't have too much because of the age of the people we work with. But certainly for communication difficulties, there is a high prevalence of both speech, language and social communication difficulties.
So I work in an adult setting, so we have people that are adults, so from 18 up until potentially the end of life. So we can have people up into being really elderly within an adult prison setting. So with the younger people, we have a very similar picture to that which Christian has just outlined around the neurodevelopmental needs and around things like ADHD, learning disability, autism. But we also find that people have gone on to do various things after leaving young offenders, so that they have acquired things like head injuries. So they may have fallen off a wall, tried to, climb something and fallen off of it. They may have been involved in a fight and been hit and acquired a head injury. Lots of people I work with have been in road traffic accidents and have acquired head injuries as well. And the evidence base shows us that there is no such thing as an insignificant head injury. And the compounding effect of lots of small head injuries is actually just as dramatic as having one huge traumatic brain injury. So there's people with a lot of frontal lobe damage, which impacts on the way that they might present with their personality and the way they might interact. In addition to that, we have people who have perhaps had a really tough time growing up, who have then started to self-medicate with substances. So they may have years and years and years of substance misuse, which damages their neurology, which impacts on their communication skills. And then we also find that they have possibly been in prison for a really long time or been on the fringe of society for a really long time. So they haven't been practicing skills around speech, language and communication. They've become really isolated. And so I meet people who will say to me, you know, I think I've got word finding difficulties. And on assessment, they perhaps have only low level word finding difficulties, but through the day, they have very few conversations, and the conversations are very much the same thing, like, can you unlock me to get some cleaning materials? Thank you very much. And that's kind of the sum total of interaction for them. So their actual skills have eroded and they've become sort of naive to the best way to have interactions and to communicate. So it's a massive deal for them to speak about something like a topic at length and try and remember information and make like an interesting narrative to share with a person. And then we've got lots and lots of people with mental health needs within a prison setting. So mental health needs will also impact on how a person can attend to an interaction, their impulsivity, their ability to access vocabulary. So it's massive across the board. And then we have all of the things that the aging population has. But in an adult prison, the person's kind of health experience is 20 years older than their chronological age. So you might meet a person who's 40, but who actually has the physical health experience of a person who's 60. So there are people having strokes, having dementia, having neurological conditions like Parkinson's disease or, you know, motor neuron disease, multiple sclerosis, those sorts of issues within the adult prison. So it's a really mixed bag. And that means that we have all of these issues with speech, language, communication, and some swallowing as well thrown in at the side there.
So what kind of challenges are there in the prison environment for someone with a communication difficulty or whatever that may be?
So I think Jackie was talking about the opportunity to practice language, and I think that's hugely important. And, you know, similarly, the young people that I work with also tell a similar tale in terms of limited ability or opportunity for practicing the use of formal language, because they might be in a setting where they're talking to the peers in slang all the time. And it's particularly relevant when they're coming up for release, where they're going to have to interact with the public, whether it's even booking a taxi or, you know, going for job interviews, etc. So that can pose a challenge. There's also the risk of people with communication difficulties being alienated. So as humans, we're kind of tribal, right? So we would like to fit in a tribe. We like to form tribes. And that can be particularly apparent in a prison where you have your sort of cohort, for example. So if you have difficulty with conversation, maybe being able to infer information, there's a lot of things that goes unsaid, or actually being unable to read a person's body language, then actually your ability to keep yourself safe can be quite compromised. Also, you do have other people who, unfortunately, because of maybe a lisp or a stammer, can get picked on. You know, you stand out, and it's an environment where you particularly want to stand out, you know, from the rest. And that can have, you know, two effects. They can either sort of keep themselves away from everyone or actually try and overcompensate by getting themselves in lots of fights. So any sort of perceived violation, as it's called, entering a physical altercation. So that can be really tricky as well. But also, I think the ability of someone to get their needs met is also compromised when they have a communication difficulty. So in prison, you are competing for the attention of a limited amount of prison officers, and you have to be able to get your point across quite quickly, quite concisely, your ability to be persuasive as well, your ability to be assertive. If all those things are compromised, then actually your ability to get your needs met is hugely reduced for someone who's got those skills already. Similarly, we have a process called adjudications, where if an incident has happened, essentially it's like a mini court where the case is heard and you have to put your point across. So you can see that for someone with a communication difficulty, that process, they are immediately at a disadvantage if they're unable to sort of say what's happened to them in a concise way, in a sequential way, in a way that makes sense. then actually their ability to have that fair hearing is hugely limited. And also, I think importantly, people with communication difficulties, language difficulties, their ability to access the education, the intervention. So those things that you might class as rehab is hugely limited if they're unable to access those things, which are usually verbally mediated interventions.
Wow. So, I mean, again, a lot to think about there, especially I think the forming narratives for adjudications and reading between the lines and things like that. So thinking about someone who may be accessing the justice system for the first time and maybe on remand awaiting trial, what could that experience be like if you have a communication difficulty?
I'll start first, and I'm sure Jackie will speak about the adult estate. So, I mean, the word that comes to mind is overwhelming. It's a new environment. There's a lot going on. There's language and jargon you haven't heard before. You're trying to keep yourself safe. You're in a heightened state. Even when you first come into custody, there is an induction process where different agencies come to you to say, OK, this is what we do. If you need help, this is how to access us. Even that process can be hugely overwhelming for someone with communication difficulty, and being able to sort of process, understand, retain that information. So when they do need the help, they're able to access it. You also have a lot of leaflets flying through your door. And actually, if you've got literacy difficulties or, you know, dyslexia, it's difficult to take in all that information. So definitely that's one word that comes to mind in terms of overwhelming.
When we have people coming into the adult estate for the first time, I would agree with Christian that there's a lot of intense emotions being experienced. And especially for a person coming in as an adult first time to prison, their only reference points are the things they've seen on television. And although, you know, some of what's represented, say, on a documentary might be okay in terms of what it's representing, obviously, if it's made for TV, they're only showing edited highlights. So, you know, a person can have a really skewed expectation of what it's like to come into prison. So although there's times when there's a lot of noise and a lot going on, there's also long hours of being alone behind your door, you know, having a lot of thinking time, trying to figure out what you're doing and how you're doing it. There's a lot of frustration around trying to contact outside agencies, particularly when you first come into prison and you need to get things sorted, such as your telephone code so that you can phone out, and some credit on your telephone account. So initially you might come into prison completely unplanned. You don't know anybody's phone numbers, because when you're on the outside of prison, they're stored in your phone. So they're not stored in your head. And you may arrive in prison, might take a week for your for information to be put on your account so that you can actually ring someone. And you might not know the name of your solicitor that was the duty solicitor that you met in the police station for 5 minutes, and you can't Google it. So there's a real challenge around arriving, feeling overwhelmed, having a lot of intense emotions. And that is really scary. So there's quite a lot of people that are triggered into a sort of feeling scared and having that flight or fight response. So, you know, lots of people that have come into the adult estate for that first period, which is their highest learning curve, they can be quite isolating and sort of not want to get involved in anything while they try and figure out how they're going to navigate what is actually a very complicated social structure, the multi-layers of different things going on in prisons, and how both officers and people who are residing in the prison kind of navigate their interactions. It's very subtle. It's kind of a sociolinguistic sort of context all of its own that's unique, really. So it's really a huge learning curve. And I would link it very much to the demands and capacities model that was originally explored for people who stammer, where it says that you've got a certain amount of capacity within your resilience and within yourself. And that if the demand is higher than that capacity, you're not going to cope. And that's kind of how arriving in prison is, that there's an awful lot to take in. There's so much going on that there's chaotic times, but also acres of quiet time, and that it's very, very disconcerting for people. They're like a fish out of water.
I mean, how can those barriers be tackled to improve successful communication within the prison system? And what is already happening within Feltham and HMP Berwyn to support this?
Well, I was going to talk about generally about the barriers first, and then Christian and I will talk about specifically what we're doing in each of our settings. Ideally, what could we do to tackle the barriers is all around early identification. So the sooner we know that a person has got a problem, the better we can support that person. And that's not just as speech and language therapists, but that's as all professionals that are working within criminal justice. So ideally, if a person can be identified as having a communication difficulty when they're in police custody, then support can be put in place, reasonable adaptations can be made. Some liaison and diversion teams have got speech and language therapists working as part of their settings. And that is brilliant because it means that advice can be put into place really early on. It would be really great if there was speech and language therapy services that for a person who isn't on remand and maybe are going to return to their home address while awaiting what's going to happen next with them, it would be really good if there was community speech and language therapy teams that would accept that referral. But there isn't many areas that have that either. There's small pockets of forensic teams, but they're not equally located across the country. So there's a real postcode lottery going on as to whether you might get identified or not in the police station and referred to someone that's going to support you or not if you get to go home. And then if you get to go to prison, you know, that again, it's patchy. Not every prison has a speech and language therapy service. It's really good also if we could foster really brilliant communication links between the police, the courts, the prisons and any other providers so that we can share patients' needs with their consent and maybe even develop like communication passports that the person can take with them between these different agencies so that information is known, because it's something we could support really easily, but the person is not going to say when they're in court, you know, time out, let me just tell you about my communication difficulties. They're going to stand there and be petrified and just acquiesce to everything. And then the last thing that we really need is lots and lots of training to support people to understand what communication needs are. Because if we could train everybody, then they would use those skills regardless of the person having an identified need. So we would be meeting the needs of the person, you know, just by dint of really good practice.
I mean, absolutely. Getting people into the right access to the right services early on would be game changing for a lot of the people that we support as intermediaries as well. And just knowing there must be so many other people there who maybe don't have access to the support that they might be needing because it hasn't been identified at police interviews or by their solicitors at that point in time.
Christian, what are you doing at Feltham in respect of tackling barriers within your setting?
So I think you mentioned a couple of things there, and you know, you spoke about liaison with the different parts of the justice system, which can be quite difficult. And you're right, you know, I think it's fantastic that there are now more speech language therapists in community teams, in YOTS, the intermediaries. So we try very hard, and actually, to be fair, that YOTS get in contact with us. If they know someone's coming to Feltham, for example, they might drop myself or my colleague Edith an email to say, look, this person's come to Feltham, this is what we've identified, perhaps these are the strategies that have been recommended. And that's a great starting point, because what that means is I can then sort of liaise with the officers at reception receiving that person, or the unit they're going to be on, so staff have a better idea of how to relate to that person. Because, yeah, you can't underestimate the value of connecting with someone in a way that, you know, it's as meaningful. Then you're able to, you know, form good relationships, minimize frustration, and support them on their journey here. So certainly liaison with different agencies is a huge one. And also training, that is huge. And I think what training allows us to do is create and foster a communication friendly environment. where everyone is aware of good ways of just communicating with each other, being aware of the language we're using, explaining jargon, you know, checking for understanding. It's something that we should just be doing as, you know, part and parcel of our everyday roles, regardless of what you're doing in the community. So definitely training as well. We were lucky in Feltham in terms of having a good foundation set up for us. The service has been set up for a little while, and we've taken that and run with it. But what that means is people are now more aware of, you know, what we do, and we're becoming, you know, we're getting more appropriate referrals. So last week, for example, I was linking in with a community offender manager. We had a young adult who was being released. And he was an autistic young man who had some language difficulties as well. And actually, they have a set of easy read license conditions that you can now change and adapt accordingly and present to that young adult. So he sent that through and sent through what was applicable for that particular young adult. So I and his offender manager could go through that with him and just help to make sure he fully understands what was expected of him on his release, so he doesn't violate those conditions. So license conditions are conditions a person must stick to in order to remain in the community and prove they're safe. So those relationships are hugely important. And we've also become a key part of our neurodiversity clinics, where, you know, we spoke about the importance of identification. So that's huge, identifying those people with neurodiverse conditions and being able to assess and provide the right support. And also, we always bang on about communication passports. And if I had my way, I mean, everyone would have a communication passport. But that's important. And again, you know, that's been acknowledged, I think, right across the criminal justice system, actually, which is really, really good to see.
At HMP Berwyn, we're a new prison, and we're the largest prison in the UK. So we have occupancy space for over 2,000 people. So it's a really big setting. And one of the things that we've tried really hard to do is to be a kind of a new prison for a new generation. So we're a digital prison. So every man has in their rooms, they have a laptop. Now, that's not connected to the internet, but it is connected to our intranet. So there's a kind of an in-house Berwyn electronic system that people can access. And they also have televisions that have cable TV. But again, it's not like Netflix and stuff. It's in-house television. So we have like a health channel on there. So there's all sorts of things going on digitally, which is a double-edged sword, really, in terms of a barrier for communication, because for the younger people, it's really great. They get it. They understand how to use a computer. They're all over emailing their family. They've got their phone in their room. They can phone people, and they can receive photos on their computer of their via email and things. So it's really nice. But for older people, or maybe people who haven't had the opportunity to learn about technology, so maybe people that have been street homeless for many years, there's a real barrier there around their expectation of whether or not they can use all of these kind of high tech ways of interacting and communicating. So ordering your food, there's a sort of an online menu that you can use to order what you're going to be eating tomorrow. But that's really challenging if you don't know how to use the computer and you can't read and write. So we've adapted that to have photographs of the food so that it's kind of an easy read menu. And that's really great for communication. So we're ticking many boxes, but we're learning lots about what needs to happen around being a digital prison to make it easier for people.
So have you seen changes in the needs of people's communication difficulties being met and the needs of the neurodiverse population being addressed in your time working at HMP Berwyn and at Feltham?
Yeah, I mean, I can answer for Feltham. And I think increasingly it's been recognised, one, the prevalence of speech language communication needs. And I think when that happens, if you're lucky, you get some more resources. And that's been the case for us in Feltham. So, you know, it was myself for a few years, and now my colleague Edith has started. So we're better able to meet the needs of our population here. So HMP Feltham is unique in that it has an under 18 section, which are our young people, so 15 to 18, and then 18 to 21. So I focus more on the young adults, and Edith focuses more on the young people. And what that affords us the opportunity to do is be more creative in how we're supporting our population. So, you know, we both run social communication groups, you know, are more able to help our young adults advocate for themselves, for example. So if they need legal help and extra legal help, there's a really good organization that can do that. But actually for them, being able to pick up the phone and know what to say and being able to advocate for themselves. Some of them need a little more help to be able to do that, as well as supporting through people to get in the parole, practicing for their parole hearing. So with more resource, we're better able to cater to the communication needs of our population.
So HMP Berwyn opened in April of 2017, I want to say. Though it might be 2018. Either way, we've been open for a few years now. And when I first started at the beginning, the officers were super duper intrigued to meet a speech and language therapist. And as with kind of your average person that you might meet on the street, they had no idea what a speech and language therapist does and thought that perhaps it was elocution. And if I can say one thing as a strapline, is speech and language therapy is not elocution. So to start with, the prison officers had no idea what I was there to do. And they just thought I was kind of a fluffy extra that had been purchased and that there was no meaningful reason for me being there. And I've done lots and lots and lots of training with people to raise their awareness. But I've also tried to demonstrate my usefulness with actions. So I've tried to use deeds, not words, to demonstrate that actually changing communication and tweaking things is going to make a big difference. And I've carved out a bit of a specialism for myself amongst the men who are incarcerated in prison, who are perhaps the hardest to engage with, perhaps the ones that are more likely to communicate by their actions rather than words. So they might be the people that are more likely to self-harm or to damage property or to become a little bit feisty and end up in some sort of physical altercation. And working with the team around that person as well as that person has shown that I can help them develop a plan that we can then use with that individual, and their behavior and their choices and their ways of solving problems can be turned around so that they become much more able to cope and much more able to explain themselves, and the incidence of needing to put hands on a person and restrain them goes down. So It's been interesting talking to people who I started with at the beginning, who kind of thought, well, you know, she's just here to be fluffy, to those people being the ones who ring me when someone's really upset, and I'll roll up my sleeves and go and see a person who's really upset. And I think they've kind of had to readjust their expectations of what a middle-aged woman doddering around can actually come to the party, because I think they've realised that communication is more important than they thought, and that I'm tougher than they thought I would be. So
remarkable middle-aged woman, Jackie.
Absolutely.
And then I've also done lots of work when Christian was talking about the fact that lots of the interventions that are in place as part of the rehabilitation of people are spoken interventions. So there's an assumption that a person has got the skills and knowledge of GCSE level, which is not true, that they do not have that in the prison setting. And so I've done a lot of work with the forensic psychology team, who present those interventions, to look at what do people understand and take in, and how do people learn best in a group setting where group communication is going on, and what are the dynamics of that. And I've done lots and lots of work with them to kind of problem solve some of the barriers when they've got lots of diverse needs in the room. So they may have a person with learning disabilities sat next to a person with ADHD, sat next to a person that has poor emotion regulation, and when they're upset, they can't explain themselves verbally. And you can imagine the challenge of trying to work with those people. So there was a period of time where I assessed every single person that was going to go into those groups just to get a baseline of what does your average person look like. And not a single person going into those groups were at an adult or age appropriate level for their understanding of grammar and their understanding of vocabulary. So all of them were at the level of a primary school child in terms of how long the sentence can be, how complicated the sentence can be, whether you can mention something and then refer back to it later, and whether they can cope with that level of sophistication in language, whether they know vocabulary. So they know prison-based vocabulary, like they know what incarcerated is, but they don't know, for example, embrace. They'd know hug, but they wouldn't know embrace. So there's little windows in their vocabulary that is at an advanced level, like the word incarcerate, but that is not typical of all of their language throughout. So when you have a person who talks about being incarcerated or being adjudicated, these are all very, very flashy words, and you think, oh, they must be very sophisticated communicators. But they've got a handful of flashy words that they've acquired because they're really exposed to them. Everyday flashy words, no, they don't have those. So lots and lots of chatting is done by myself about us not using flashy words. So that would be my take home message for people at this point as well.
I mean, you're absolutely spot on, Jackie. And actually, it's nice when you actually start to notice the prison taking note of how we benefit the system. So, you know, advocating that, you know, flashy word to not use, or actually being invited to some of their processes. So for young people, young adults who probably more young adults, actually, who are classed as more violent or more prone to violence, there's a procedure called a CSIP. Do you have that, Jackie?
Yeah, we have CSIPs.
I have no idea what CSIP stands for.
That was going to be my next question. What's a CSIP?
It's a support plan. That's what S&P stands for. Individual plan. It's a multidisciplinary positive behaviour support plan.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's what it is. And by us being at the table of those discussions to highlight those breakdown in communication, or actually, wait, are you sure that person understood what you were saying at that point, or could you have given that instruction a different way? Or actually, he probably wasn't able to process and understand at that time because he was too heightened, etc. And just give that take on how that person's communication style might affect their behavior. So, you know, more frequently we're being invited to sit around this table of those discussions now, and it's great because it's going to benefit those young people or young adults or adults that we work with.
And that you make such a valid point, Christian, because I go to there's a meeting that's held for some of the more challenging people that's called a good review. That stands for good order or discipline. So those are people who are disrupting the good order of the establishment. So I go to those meetings to offer continuity of care and to demystify the communication that's going on. And the number of times people are either talking in very complex language about adjudications and incarcerations and all those flashy words, or they're talking in terms like, oh, we'll get this boxed off, and once we've crossed all the T's, we'll be able to. And, you know, those sorts of phrases, you know, the see me as a sounding board phrases, they're super duper unhelpful. I'm there to try and take away the flashy language and take away all the inferring and all the idioms and all the kind of colloquialisms. And we're not getting our ducks in a row. We're making a plan and addressing that stuff. And it is chipping away at something that is making a difference. But it's dead hard for people because they've spent all of their time learning to speak in a certain way, and we're asking them to code switch, and it's not a skill that they've acquired or thought about having before. So, you know, we're asking people to add an additional skill to their skill set when they're already doing a busy and stressful job. So it's lots.
It's so interesting because your observations about what's going on in the prison setting are very similar to the recommendations that an intermediary may make in court, such as using everyday vocabulary rather than complex jargon, or having avoiding using those idioms and that figurative language and saying what you mean so everyone can understand what you mean and not having to work out and read between the lines. So what do you think was the catalyst for these amazing changes in interventions and training and almost culture within the settings that you're working in?
I think that there's an understanding that if you go to work in a prison, you want to do a good job. So people want to be able to help. They haven't, you know, they can earn the same money stacking shelves in Tesco's. Other supermarkets are available. But they've gone to work in a really challenging environment. So they must do that because their value base is in the right place. So they want to help. They want to see change happen. They want to look after people. Very few people go to work in prison because they enjoy being sworn at or they enjoy having to put hands on a person. That isn't the case. I think the catalyst for change is recognizing that people want to do a good job. They want to help. You know, they want to have that little bit of you know, silver lining and warm fuzzy moment of thinking, do you know what? I've worked with that person for 3 years and they were a pain in the backside and now they're being released and they're actually, you know, they've got hope of doing well. So I think there's lots of value-based motivations. And I know that within my setting, people are busy and they work hard and they get tired and they want to be able to effectively communicate so that everyone can have an easier day and we can all just, you know, get done whatever needs to be done. So sort of demonstrating the value of speech and language therapy in the context of a prison, you know, people have a light bulb moment where the I'm using all these figurative language now, where the penny drops and they that actually what we're doing is very, very based in verbal interactions, the way that we engage with people and helping people do differently.
I think you're right, Jackie Neil, sorry to jump in there, but also I think the evidence is there. So when, for example, when we were going out to tender, which, you know, NHS trusts do from time to time, there was a health needs analysis done. And actually, when you do look at the data, it's there in terms of the evidence for, you know, speech and language therapy. And it helps that we're here, you know, showing our value and, you know, contributing, and that's being seen, that we're playing our part with the ultimate aim of, you know, reducing reoffending.
You are so right there, Christian, because actually, you know, I'm thinking about the kind of officers that I engage with on a daily basis. But actually, when you kind of step back and look at it from the point of view of service commissioning and looking at the needs of the population, the health needs assessments throughout prisons demonstrate the need for speech and language therapy and the vulnerabilities that are there and the value of it. And we've also started measuring our outcomes in a much more distinct way, using things like outcome measures and stuff like that, so that we can demonstrate to commissioners that we're actually shockingly good value for money.
How well would you say that people in the system engage with the support and services that you have available, and what factors can impact on that level of engagement? Because it sounds like that you're measuring the outcomes, the need has been identified. So how is the engagement?
So in my experience, I think our young people and young adults here in Feltham engage with speech and language therapy very well, actually. Probably across the board, at the very least, they get a chance out of their room, wear a friendly face. Well, I like to think so anyway. But also, once they start to understand how this benefits them and how this can apply to various aspects of their life, then you really get that engagement, because they know, actually, no, this is going to help me, because my ultimate aim is to get out of here, you know, change my friendship circle, maybe get a job, maybe. And actually being aware, and I think for me, that's the main thing when I'm working with these young people, young adults, them being aware of their communication style, what helps, what doesn't help, what they're good at, when they're good at it. So understanding themselves a little bit better, which everyone tries to do, that's really powerful for me. So they can advocate for themselves and, you know, make the changes that they need to in order to, you know, do what they want to do when they leave custody or whilst they're in custody. And in terms of the factors that can affect the level of engagement, I think one, actually, them being aware of that the service is available. So actually, we try and make ourselves quite visible during induction and, you know, our colleagues. Luckily, with education, with the officers, they're aware that we're around, so they can sort of signpost as well. But also, in terms of another factor of engagement is, have they actually got their basic needs met first? So do they feel safe? You know, are they eating? Are they sleeping well? They need to have those basic things met before they can actually engage in anything else. So if, for example, they're feeling incredibly threatened or they're very stressed because they've got an upcoming court case or they've got, you know, money on the head, whatever it is, you have to be aware of those things because you need to address those things for them to be in a place to engage in the service. They also have to be motivated to engage. And sometimes that motivation comes from them understanding the value of what you're offering to them. And actually, sometimes it's quite nice because their peers refer them. So they see their peers working with speech language therapy. They ask if they can work, you know, with the team as well and how they can support them. So yeah, those are some factors I'd say affect the level of engagement.
I've had gentlemen write me little notes about the person that they maybe share a cell with or a person that they know that they're sort of, you know, I'm worried about so-and-so and I think that you're the one who can help. And that's it's a really interesting thing then to try and navigate, because you then have to try and meet that person and kind of introduce the idea without exposing the fact that their mate has written a note about them. So it can be very cute.
So moving through an individual's journey of their time in prison, I wanted to ask about when a sentence comes to an end and how may communication difficulties affect someone as they leave prison and return to live in the community.
Well, this is a huge issue, really, because we're there supporting the person and we really want them to have a good understanding of their own strengths and their own challenges and how they can use their strengths to address their challenges. We want them to leave with their communication passport and loads of skills in being autonomous and being able to self-advocate and appropriate assertiveness that isn't aggression. And we can work with them for a long time trying to achieve all of these things. But when they leave, it can be really difficult because we don't know necessarily if they're going to go back to an environment where things went wrong before, whether they're going to have the same peer group, whether they're going to have housing or not. Lots of my gentlemen leave prison to be no fixed abode, which is really incredibly difficult. So, you know, we do a lot of work building people up, but we know that we're sending them out to stressful situations. And the communication needs of that person, it's pervasive in everything that they need to do after they've left prison. So relationships, finding and securing housing, finding and securing employment, filling in all the forms, getting a bank account, ringing up somewhere to try and get benefits or to try and ask a query, navigating even those menus when you ring up a helpline and you have to push button one for this and button four for that, and remembering all of that verbal information and which selection fits yours best and following the instructions, it's really difficult. So there is lots of barriers and challenges, and often there isn't always a community-based service that we can refer to. So sometimes a person has got learning disability and we can refer to the community learning disability team, but sometimes they don't have a diagnosis or, you know, they don't fit with any of the criteria of the sort of standard commissioned services in a geographic area. Or that service has a huge waiting list. So we might have a person that fits with a mental health service, for example, in terms of their criteria, but their waiting list might be 12 months, and that's so long to wait. So it's incredibly hard to be able to pass the case over to someone who's gonna take up that case and support that person and continue to scaffold them until they're on their feet. And I think that period, those first few months after you leave prison, is the most vulnerable time. That things can go wrong, the person can feel desperate. I've got people who say to me, you know, if I go out to be no fixed abode, then I'm going to go and break a shop window because I'll be rearrested, and then I can come back to prison where I've got food, shelter, heating, I feel safe. You know, that sleeping rough is an incredibly scary thing, particularly in the time of COVID. You know, so it's kind of heartbreaking. And this feeds into the revolving door of returning to prison, because in a lot of ways, the function of prisons is to give very vulnerable people in society secure housing. So it's an incredibly sad situation.
But you're right, because, you know, you're often left feeling sad when you have people you're working with leave, because, you know, the service, the services in the community, particularly to support the communication and particularly for adults, are almost non-existent. And for me, that's where the work should start, you know, because, you know, you said, Jackie, those few months after leaving custody are the most vulnerable, right? So who is there to, you know, advocate on your behalf? I know you should be able to self-advocate, but to allow people to understand your communication needs, to do stuff like, so for me, even those social communication groups, they will be more effective. Yes, they can be effective coming towards the end, but actually when you're released, and actually if, for example, you've got a job interview coming up and you had a speech and language therapist or, you know, another professional who might be able to support you through that process, help you to navigate that, to give yourself the best possible chance of doing your best in that situation, then yeah, you're onto a winner. But unfortunately, these services are just not existent, and it's sad.
Yeah.
Helping them, certainly, you know, I think I mentioned before, supporting them to understand their communication needs, I think is important. But also linking in with whatever services are available in the community. I spoke about linking in with community offender managers, or, you know, maybe writing a letter to the GP to just to let them know about the person's presentation. We can run social communication groups and give them that practice just before they leave. But yeah, I think what's particularly relevant, it's that linking in with the outside agencies and, you know, making sure they're aware of the communication passports. I think for the under 18s, actually, you have the youth offending teams. And as we said earlier, they have more resources, and usually there's a speech and language therapist attached to a yacht, which is really good. So actually having that link is really important and can be really beneficial in just holding that young person through that transition period.
I mean, in the case of adults, I've made links with as many community providers as I'm kind of able to, and as I'm discovering them. So there's third sector things. So there might be charities that are working in sort of thinking about maybe people that have got a substance misuse issue, but I might have a person that's got a communication need and also a substance misuse issue. So I can kind of link them in with that service and then do some work with that service before they leave to talk about that person's needs. So I'm kind of subverting whatever their funding and their aims and goals were by kind of getting them to take on the challenge of supporting this person. So there's linking in with some charities. I also try and link in with social services and social workers. Then some of my gentlemen go to approved premises, so I try and link in there. So it's trying to be creative with whatever is out there that I can kind of get the person to fit the criteria for them, and then share information and try and make it work. But it's all very, very creative kind of problem solving, and it's very time consuming, which I'm more than happy to do it, but again, it then takes resource from doing face-to-face work with a person. So it's all a juggle.
But I think also, Jackie, the just so sometimes the referrals to some of these agencies, for example, we might refer a person to get a Care Act assessment, but usually they need a diagnosis in order to access those services. And we know that, you know, some the adults and people we work with don't always have a diagnosis. And you might even argue that sometimes the diagnosis is not always helpful, because you should be able to work with someone based on the presentation, not merely a diagnosis. So that makes it increasingly difficult as well, because in order to access those services, essentially you need a diagnosis, which is, it's not always helpful.
And definitely, because our chaps have often had chaotic childhoods, so perhaps weren't taken to appointments with healthcare providers, or perhaps didn't go to school. So they didn't get a chance to be seen by a Senko and then seen by a paediatrician and then attend a specialist appointment with whatever. And, you know, so you're completely spot on. They don't have the opportunity to get those diagnoses. And then it's really hard to get them as adults.
A lot of challenges, but it sounds like a lot of creativity from both of you at that point in someone's journey. Thinking at the broader picture, so do you think there is enough awareness of communication difficulties within the criminal justice system as a whole?
I think it's patchy. I think there's some awareness, but nowhere near enough. And, you know, the criminal justice system, you know, starts at even liaison, you know, those police officers that go into schools and advocate for, you know, how to interact with the police, etc. I think what I'm trying to say is I think it should be pervasive at every point in the criminal justice system. You know, we talk about a person being able to effectively participate in legal proceedings. And I think, Amy, you know, you do an amazing job as an intermediary in helping people through that point. But yeah, it's not always well understood. And, you know, some young people say to me, actually in court, I'm just listening out for the only time I pay attention is when they're sentencing me. I'm just listening out for how much I've got, how long I've got, as opposed to being able to, you know, meaningfully engage in the process from the start, being able to explain, you know, your version of events, so you're being treated fairly. And I think that's a huge miscarriage of justice. So there is some awareness, and I think there is some good work going on, but it's nowhere near enough. But I think also there's limited understanding of how communication difficulties affect a person's prison experience. You know, the fact that they're more likely to be adjudicated or more likely to be restrained, and you don't often hear that side of the story. But yeah, we're fighting a good fight, and I think that, you know, this podcast is contributing to that.
Thank you so much to Jackie and Christian for giving up some of their time to talk to us. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please let us know on Twitter or LinkedIn. You can find out more about our Access Injustice series by visiting www.communicourt.co.uk. Thank you for listening.